Beatles in the USSR. Paul Gambaccini reveals how the music of the world's most famous pop group was heard in the Soviet Union during the 1960s.
I'm Ringo and I play the drums.
Well, I'm Paul and I play the bass.
I'm George and I play a guitar.
I'm John and I too play a guitar. Sometimes I play the fool.
Hello, I'm Paul Gambaccini. I distinctly remember the first time I heard The Beatles. It was Christmas week, 1963. Stan Z. Burns, on radio station WINS New York, announced he was going to play a request for English dock workers on the west side of Manhattan who wanted to hear the British number one. He put on I Want to Hold Your Hand. I had never heard anything like it, and I always remember it. What I didn't realize was that millions of young people across America were experiencing their own version of my Stan Z. Burns moment. 6 weeks later, on Friday, the 7th of February, 1964, a plane carrying the Beatles touched down in New York. I Want to Hold Your Hand was now at the top of the American charts. The Fab Four were going to appear in 2 days' time in front of a huge television audience on the Ed Sullivan Show. This is how BBC reporter Malcolm Davis described the Beatles' ecstatic reception in the States.
Well, they have arrived, and such a reception has never been given a head of state, at least one that would compare with the welcome the Beatles received when they flew into New York. Friday morning, I went out to Kennedy International Airport for an experience that I'm sure will never be duplicated.
This is the moment they're waiting for. Here they arrive. They're stepping off the plane now.
The Beatles' live appearance on Ed Sullivan's TV show was more than just promotional. It was a cultural event that introduced them to the USA and changed the lives of a generation of Americans. When they appeared on the 9th of February, 1964, audience anticipation was so great, the ratings registered 73 million viewers. The program was the most watched television show ever to that point. The United States fell in love with the young men from Liverpool. Their records dominated radio. Their faces monopolized magazines. Images of John, Paul, George, and Ringo appeared on all kinds of merchandise, from wallpaper and pillowcases to soft drinks and bubblegum. In the first week of April, they had each of the top five hits in America. Beatlemania spread throughout the world. Young people embraced their music and personalities in Australia, Japan, and Western Europe. But this was at a time when the Cold War between the capitalist West and communist East was at its chilliest. In the USSR, the music of the Beatles was repressed by the government. Yet, as we'll hear, my fellow teenagers on the other side of the world somehow discovered the Beatles and, against all the odds, listened to and loved their records. We'll also discover why the Beatles were responsible for the widespread vandalism of payphones in the Soviet Union. Our witnesses who lived in the USSR during the 1960s are Yuri Pelushinuk, whose teenage years were spent in Minsk and now works in Canada, and Oleksiy Solohubenko, a journalist at the BBC World Service who grew up in Kiev. As they recall, even before they'd heard a note of Beatles music, they noticed a new word had entered the language, Beatli. Here's Oleksiy.
That meant anybody with long hair who was slightly unruly and was playing this odd music. Or not even playing odd music, but pretending that they knew what this odd music was all about.
It was a word generally used to describe any rhythmic melody which has a sound of electrical guitar in it. First time I have heard this word around me, it was a kindergarten. We were beside the gates, and on the other side of the gates was a teenager passing by with a transistor radio, and it was some sort of music, rhythmic music, and we all yelling and screaming, Beatly, Beatly.
You're listening to Beatles in the USSR, a special podcast from the BBC. The Beatles' first hit in their home country was Love Me Do, entering the charts in October 1962. That month, the relationship between the USA and the USSR reached its lowest point when the Cuban Missile Crisis took the world to the brink of nuclear war. We watched anxiously as the American President Kennedy and Soviet Premier Khrushchev came to a showdown over the installation of Soviet missiles on the island of Cuba. The world breathed a collective sigh of relief when a solution was found to the standoff. But, as Alexei explains, the highly charged conflict had repercussions back in the USSR.
The West was cut off in many ways. You heard about Cuba, about the crisis, you heard about the perfidious West and how it was trying to corrupt everything and staging provocations here and there. But the reality for many people was that they didn't really know what was taking place outside the country. And this was also a different age in terms of technology, because 1961, 62, 63, and I'm just using 61 because that was an important year, the first man in space, the 20th Party Congress promising communism. It was kind of cut-off period. I think those years, up to 1964, when Khrushchev was demoted, were very important because they were not the age of hope. They were the age of disillusionment. After Stalin died, there was a lot of hope that things would get easier, that the country will open up. And it didn't happen. It was actually closing up again. Shortwave radio was not yet readily available. Television was very, very basic. So it was kind of a country trying perhaps to come out of the cold, but not really succeeding and making life for people on the ground very, very difficult.
In July 1964, the Beatles' first movie, A Hard Day's Night, played a significant role in showcasing the group's music and image, not only in the USA, but throughout most of the world. There is a joyous scene in the film when the Beatles energetically run and jump about on a playing field as Can't Buy Me Love plays on the soundtrack. A Hard Day's Night was not shown in the USSR, but in 1966, Can't Buy Me Love was broadcast on Russian TV, but with a very different context.
It was a program fronted by Valentin Zorin, who was a Soviet commentator, one of the few who was allowed relatively good access to the Western world, particularly in America. And he was famous in filming, say, a program about the best houses of Philadelphia, what it meant. And you'll have this footage of hungry people in Philadelphia juxtaposed against the mansions in Philadelphia suburbs. And that program was fronted by Can't Buy Me Love. However, as far as I remember, the interpretation was the opposite, that actually there is this Western perception that you can buy love, you can buy anything with money, and this obsession with money is important. Yeah, that topped and tailed this program. I'm not sure a lot of people associated with the Beatles. The connoisseurs did, but the others didn't. Beatles was the subculture. It was kind of the secret thing in which we were all steeped, where we exchanged ideas, exchanged thoughts, you know, where we tried to emulate them, to pick up the guitars and do it. But it was not on the official level. On the official level, Beatles didn't exist, apart from the critique of their long hair and Western ways.
In the Soviet Union, all record manufacturing was controlled by the state-owned company Melodia. Any music from the West deemed suitable for Soviet record buyers was distributed by the label. To Yuri's great surprise, having heard Can't Buy Me Love on Russian TV, a Beatles track had been sanctioned for release on record.
Teenagers immediately put the song Can't Buy Me Love into the Russian language. And the second song which was put into the Russian language was Girl. The song Girl, it's interesting for me and it's enigma for me up to this day. It was issued by the Soviet state company Melody. They collected various artists from various countries all around the world. Among them, someone subversive person, you know, I don't know whom to thank, but put this song Girl. And it was shown as if it is folk song.
Released in the West on the Beatles album Rubber Soul, Lennon and McCartney's Girl escaped on the Russian compilation LP Musical Kaleidoscope Volume 8. The song was credited on the sleeve to The Beatles Quartet with the statement, "Music and lyrics are traditional."
That was the first time that I heard a Beatles song in quality. That was the first experience, and I think it's deeply ironic that the Soviet record company brought me the first Beatles song in quality without calling it a Beatles song. I don't know why. There's no rational explanation. Folk was acceptable. Rock was a taboo. Therefore, if you could reclassify something as a folk, which, you know, is the only logical explanation that I have, that it was okay. But again, you would never, never hear a Beatles song on radio. Radio was also very limited. I'm talking about Soviet radio at the time.
With their music banned from the airwaves and just one song available on an official record, Soviet fans were forced to seek alternative ways to hear the Beatles.
There were two privileged groups of people in the Soviet Union. One were the diplomats, and they were mostly in Moscow, and they could bring in some stuff, including the Beatles LPs. And then the sailors, the merchant marine. And I know that because I lived in Ukraine, the big port was Odessa, and Odessa was a big naval center, and you had several flotillas. The whale hunters were there that went out and were docked in Western ports, so they brought this stuff back to Ukraine.
But, as Yuri recalls, vigilant customs officers were determined to prevent this particular contraband crossing the border.
If officer on duty on the custom would find this record, he would scratch it and return back with the words, "You can keep it as a souvenir. It's absolutely impossible to play." But if the clean, unscratched record was smuggled into the country, they were immediately copied on reel-to-reel tape recorders, and tapes were available everywhere, all around the Soviet Union.
There was this element of risk, the element of danger, because in the age where there were no mobile telephones and no internet, there were flash mobs. People were passing secret messages that on a given Sunday at 11 o'clock by the tube station named whatever, there'll be a little exchange that would last maybe for 30 minutes. And people would come there, would show what they have, sometimes exchange, sometimes buy. To own a record was extremely expensive. 40 rubles was the going price for a Beatles album at that time, as far as I remember. Blue jeans cost about 100 rubles, and that was higher than the average salary in a month for a doctor or a teacher. I think tape, bad quality tape, was really easy and was cheap. It cost nothing, and you could dub it off your friends, which is what was happening. But the first copies, the original copies, done on good Western imported tape machines, the first cuts, the first recordings of, say, Sgt. Pepper's with high quality tape done on a high quality machine, they were extremely expensive. They were 10, 15 rubles a go.
Reel-to-reel tapes are okay if you have an actual reel-to-reel tape recorder. But back then, not too many families could afford such an expensive toy. But everybody had turntable. It's why underground studios started to use X-ray films to groove Beatles songs on it. And these films were spread all around the Soviet Union, and the name for it, Rock and Roll on Bones. I remember my cousin bought one for 2 rubles. And it was Can Buy Me Love, and you can see someone's skull on it. And it was pretty strong record, and it lasted for a couple of months.
Although not of the highest sound quality, records etched into discarded X-ray film, surely the strangest picture discs ever, and reel-to-reel tape copies of copies of copies, brought the Beatles music to their fans in the USSR. But when they heard them, of course, they were also eager to see what they looked like. It's sobering to think that 4 of the most photographed people in the world during the 1960s could only be glimpsed in the USSR through the haze of blurry images.
It was a different age. There were no fax machines, there were no copiers, and if there were copiers, they were deeply restricted. I think the interesting thing was that the Soviet Union in the mid-60s was trying to be good to the neighbors in Eastern Europe. Therefore, you got lots of Polish magazines and some Hungarian ones. And even though you didn't read the language, you saw the pictures. And very often what you got was kind of secondhand pictures of a Polish reprint of a German magazine with the blurred picture of the Beatles.
I got my first photograph of the Beatles at school, and it was a picture which was made out of other pictures photographed and over-photographed who knows how many times. And the quality was pretty bad, but I was happy to have the photograph of the Beatles. My second photograph I obtained was the picture from the cover of the album Sgt. Pepper. And it was also bad, but at least you can find the person with the glasses and to know who is John Lennon.
I'm Paul Gambaccini. You're listening to Beatles in the USSR from the BBC. Many American rock stars, from Billy Joel to Tom Petty, have said they received their sense of vocation when they watched the Beatles' first live performance on American television in February 1964. Musicians were similarly inspired in the Soviet Union, but their plans to pick up an instrument and form groups required a great deal of ingenuity. No Western-made guitars were available, and even models from Eastern Europe were impossible to get hold of, unless you were a member of an officially sanctioned band. Homemade guitars, designed to imitate the Beatles' instruments, were made out of planks of wood. As Alexei remembers, guitar pickups to amplify the sound were also difficult to buy. But there was a readily available alternative.
The easiest thing was to unscrew the payphone and to take the microphone out of it and to slide it under the strings, which was common practice. Therefore, payphones were absolutely, you know, out of order in most Soviet cities at the time. So I think Beatles are definitely responsible for that.
Someone would bring a photograph of the Beatles, and you can see guitar in John Lennon's hands or Paul McCartney's guitar, bass, this violin bass was enormously popular. I made one, actually, for myself. But it was next to impossible to find strings for a bass guitar. And I remember me and my friend were looking for strings just before a New Year's school dance. And we found strings in the school piano and took four strings from the piano and put them on my bass. And they sounded quite well. Unfortunately, in the middle of the dance, my guitar collapsed. It was quite an embarrassment.
When Paul McCartney wrote Back in the USSR in 1968, he had no idea about the impact it would have in the USSR. It was simply a tongue-in-cheek parody of the Beach Boys and Chuck Berry's song Back in the USA.
The song Back in the USSR started a legend that the Beatles actually landed on Soviet territory on the way to Japan. As Beatles were not allowed to leave the plane, they actually gave a concert on a wing of the plane, playing acoustic guitars.
If you remember the lyrics of Back in the USSR, when they were singing, if I remember correctly, the Ukraine's girl really knocked me out, they leave all the West behind, and Moscow girls made me sing and shout, and Georgia's always on my mind. Yes, I think, you know, people thought they must have been there, not just in Moscow, but for me, growing in Ukraine, the fact that Ukrainian girls were appreciated in such a way definitely meant that they landed somewhere near Kiev.
On the 24th of May, 2003, Paul McCartney and his band played to 100,000 people packed into Red Square in Moscow. For the fans who'd first heard the Beatles on illicit tape copies and X-ray records, it was an event they could only have dreamed about before the collapse of the Soviet Union. As Yuri Polushenuk and Alexei Solohubenko explain, the world's most famous pop group had penetrated the Iron Curtain and moved a generation within the USSR.
The Beatles had this enormous influence on Soviet teenagers. If some authoritative guy on the radio, on TV, describing them as the monkeys out of the jungle, playing and drumming and screaming, and you immediately ask, and who are you to make this conclusion? And you lost respect. It's why the whole generation was lost, and all these unshakable dogmas and ideas were questioned.
I don't think it's a lost generation in the sense that it was a generation that was expected to believe in communism and then the Beatles subverted it. I think nobody really believed in communism. All those pronouncements about 20 years from 1961 and everybody would be living in communism, they were dashed by reality of daily existence. So I think there were a lot of talk over kitchen tables about how badly things were going, a lot of listening to Western radio stations, including certainly the BBC World Service and Radio Liberty and others. The Beatles' music was part of that subculture. It was real, it was palpable, it was being played, and it was two fingers to the authorities. And ironically, it was the Beatles that became part of real life for the generation, certainly my generation, the generation that was born in mid-50s and that was growing up through the 60s. It was, I think, a found generation, a generation that found itself, that actually found that there were other things and you could carve your own niche And Beatles was an important part of that niche where real values, real emotionality could exist. And even though he didn't understand the lyrics very often, you understood the spirit of it. And I think that was important. It was a different spirit to the official one that was fake and false.
Beatles in the USSR was produced by Kevin Howlett and was an independent production for the BBC by Howlett Media Productions. I'm Paul Gambaccini. Thanks for listening.